Hello and welcome to the Arizona Capital Times on Sun Sounds. My name is John Coe. I am in Flagstaff, and I will be your volunteer reader for today, reading articles that were published in the Arizona Capital Times on or about July 25th, 2025. Headline: Here's why Hobbs vetoed GOP election reform bills again. Written by Jamar Younger and published in the Arizona Capital Times on July 26th, 2025. Governor Katie Hobbs vetoed several bills this past session that were aiming to speed up the state's election results, forcing Republicans to wait at least another year to implement a Florida-style election system. The bills would have changed the deadlines for early drop-off ballots, required voters to update their names on the early active voting list within a specific time frame, and allowed schools to be used as polling places. Another would have banned voting centers. In her veto messages, Hobbs repeatedly cited concerns that the bills would restrict access to voting. Democrats agreed and routinely voted against the legislation in committees and on the House and Senate floor. Republicans made faster election results one of their top legislative priorities after many expressed frustration with the state's slow count of ballots following the November 2024 general election. Quote, Arizona is a laughingstock across the country for how long it's taking our state to determine winners and losers in this election, said Senator J.D. Mesnard, a Republican from Chandler, in a November 8th news release days after the election. Mesnard recently said slow election results could cause voters to lose faith in the election system. Quote, the length of time that it takes to get a result is not just because we're itching to know the outcome, he said. It's not that simple. It's because the longer it takes, the more outcomes appear to shift in the process, the more it breeds mistrust or a lack of faith in the election system. Mesnard introduced Senate Bill 1001, which would have required the signature and identification of a voter with an early ballot if they dropped it off after 7 p.m. on the Friday before an election. The bill would have also removed a voter from the active early voting list if they dropped off an early ballot without identification after the deadline. Mesnard introduced similar versions of the bill in recent years, but amended it this past session in hopes of seeing it through. Despite the changes, Hobbs still vetoed the measure on July 1st. In her veto message, Hobbs stated that the bill could have been inconveniencing voters who require family members or caregivers to assist them in delivering their ballots. Quote, SB 1001 still presents unacceptable challenges for voters who must rely on family members or caregivers to drop off their ballot and would be unfair to appear in person, effectively imposing an earlier deadline for them to complete their ballots than others, or risk removal from the active early voter list, Hobbs said. Mesnard disagreed with the idea that the bill would have made it more difficult for people to vote, saying that the measure aimed to disincentivize people from waiting until Election Day to drop off their ballots. Quote, the idea is, if you're not mailing your ballot back, which was the point, contributing to the cause of the delay. And so, if that's going to be the approach, then we're going to remove you from the early voting list, Mesnard said. It was a pretty soft disincentive, since you can just sign right back up again. He was unsure if he would revive the bill next session. Quote, I don't know. Maybe the third time would be the charm, he said, but I'm not so sure what I could do differently. I've tried two different approaches. I could give some thought to what another approach would be, but the governor seems pretty against the idea. Senate President Warren Peterson, a Republican from Gilbert, expressed a desire to pursue election reforms next year, although he acknowledged that nothing might happen unless a Republican governor is elected in 2026. Peterson introduced Senate Bill 1011, which was one of the first election bills to be approved by the legislature this year. The bill, along with its twin bill, HB 2703, would have required early ballots to be dropped off at a voting location by 7 p.m. on the Friday before an election. However, it would have still allowed early ballots to be delivered or mailed to a county recorder's office by 7 p.m. on Election Day. The legislation would have also called for early mail voters to confirm their address each election cycle if they lived in a county with more than 500,000 people, or every 4 years if they resided in a smaller county. In addition, the bill would have restricted a school principal from denying a request to use their school as a polling place. The bill passed the legislature in February, but Hobbs rejected it because it would have effectively ended the active early voting list, she said in her veto message. The governor would have considered compromises such as implementing the Friday early ballot drop-off restrictions while still protecting the early voting list and enacting other provisions such as same-day registration. In her veto message, Hobbs said, quote, "Unfortunately, any potential compromise was rejected, leading me to believe the focus of this legislation is disenfranchising eligible voters, not delivering faster election results to Arizonans." Headline: Pima County Sheriff denies calling ICE during traffic stops, ACLU seeks records. Written by Howard Fisher for the Arizona Capital Times and published on July 25, 2025. The ACLU is seeking records from Pima County Sheriff Chris Nanos to determine if his deputies are contacting immigration officials during traffic stops. In a new lawsuit, attorney John Mitchell claims that his organization requested information in May about the agency's practices. That, he said, specifically includes a policy about communication with federal officials to verify immigration status. He also wants to know what policies the sheriff's department uses to determine whether a traffic stop is extended for the purpose of verifying immigration status or waiting for immigration authorities to arrive. What he got, Mitchell said, was a series of delays. Worse yet, he said he has reason to believe that policies about tracking interactions with federal officials were wiped out shortly after the public records request was submitted in May. Now he wants Pima County Superior Court Judge Greg Sokol to order the documents to be produced. Nanos told Capital Media Services that there was some kind of tracking for interactions with those illegally in the country, but that it was inherited from his predecessor, Mark Napier, when he took office in 2021. Nanos said Napier was trying to gather the data in his bid to secure federal funds through Operation Stone Garden, a now-defunct program that provided money to local law enforcement agencies for border security operations. County supervisors blocked that move. However, Nanos said the no longer needed reporting requirements remained on the books without his knowledge. He said he ordered their removal not to thwart the ACLU, but because the provisions had been brought to his attention when Arizona Luminaria, an online Tucson newspaper, requested the data the reports were supposed to collect. What data was being collected since he took office, the sheriff said, were routine things like calls to Border Patrol for help in missing persons cases. However, Nanos acknowledged that his department does keep records on the ethnicity of those stopped for traffic violations. He said, though, that it is simply for, quote, auditing purposes to guard against racial profiling. He also acknowledged that the official policy regarding traffic stops and the recording of reasonable suspicion by officers requesting immigration status had changed. Nanos noted that was in a section that dealt with working with federal authorities on immigration issues. The language, he claims, went back to when Napier ran the office. That was part of a larger rewrite of the same policy, which he believes had no nefarious intent. Mitchell, however, said he's not convinced. He said there were reports by those in the Tucson community who were trying to observe interactions between community members and federal agencies, specifically Border Patrol and Immigration and Customs Enforcement. Quote, "They noticed that there were some instances of a Pima sheriff being called to a scene, either for a traffic stop or some sort of investigation, and federal immigration officials showing up as well," Mitchell told Capital Media Services. Those federal appearances, he said, led to the request for records of the communications. Quote, "We have yet to understand the extent of communications between the sheriff and the federal immigration authorities," Mitchell said. "We don't have answers because the Pima sheriff has not given us those records." Less clear is whether any calls to the feds, to the extent that they might exist, are legal. Quote, the context matters a great deal, Mitchell said. Quote, there may be legitimate reasons, or at least lawful reasons, for immigration to be called, he explained, or there may be unlawful reasons, like racial profiling or other nefarious explanations. Nanos said it is his policy that none of his deputies call immigration officials in the case where a traffic stop finds someone not here legally. In fact, he said, his agency will not cooperate with ICE, even to the point of refusing to detain someone that the agency wants. Quote, they're unconstitutional, the sheriff said. You want us to hold a prisoner? Then get us a warrant. Mitchell remained skeptical. Quote, we can't say for sure what Pima Sheriff is doing, he said, but what we can say is that they're not giving us the records we have requested so that we can make that determination. A February 27th version of the rules does say that department members, quote, shall not engage in racial or biased-based profiling. It also says they can't consider race, color, or national origin except when part of a specific suspect description. And it says offices, quote, shall document the existing reasonable suspicion in a case report. However, the language regarding what can be considered and the requirement for documentation was removed in a version of the rules dated May 21st. That's just a week after the ACLU submitted its request for public records. Quote, they do owe the public answers about the timing, Mitchell said. Quote, obviously, causation isn't established just by the fact that the sheriff changed their policy after our inquiries, he said. We have yet to understand the full circumstances. Nanos said it all came about because of the inquiry by Arizona Luminaria. Quote, once I heard of this, I immediately had staff remove that policy with the intent being to reflect current practices regarding tracking contacts with immigration officials, something I thought I had stopped when I first took office, he said. The sheriff provided Capital Media Services with some data on traffic stops for the year. He said there were 5,331 citations issued. Half of those were classified as white, with 35% identified as Hispanic motorists, 7% as African American, and smaller numbers of other groups, along with about 4% listed as unknown, or with the box on the form left blank. The numbers were pretty similar, with 2,922 warnings breaking down as follows, 55% for white, 30% for Hispanics, and 4% African Americans. Quote, I'm guessing the percentages fall pretty close in line with our county's demographics, Nanos said. And the issues the ACLU is raising? Quote, I completely understand their concern, the sheriff said, saying his staff may have been overly aggressive with the alterations. Quote, mea culpa, that's on me for not being clear, he said, but we are not done with that policy review. You're listening to the Arizona Capital Times on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Sun Sounds of Arizona has been providing information access since 1979, and you can always listen to our live stream at sunsounds.org. Headline: Lawmaker directs Auditor General, ADE, to develop ESA audits. Written by Kira Riley and published in the Arizona Capital Times on July 26, 2025. The Arizona Department of Education and the Arizona Auditor General's Office are now consulting on a risk-based auditing of the Empowerment Scholarship Account Program months after a law requiring collaboration took effect. All the while, the Department of Education is still finding its footing in auditing the program, with a small staff and a slow-moving trek toward artificial intelligence. Last session, the legislature added a provision requiring consultation with the Auditor General's office to develop risk-based auditing procedures for the state's fastest-growing school choice program. But Auditor General Lindsay Perry pointed out that a joint legislative audit committee meeting on July 21st, that 10 months after the law's effective date and 8 months after the department started its risk-based auditing, the two offices had yet to find themselves in the same room together on the issue, though not for a lack of trying. Perry said her office first reached out in January and had since been unsuccessful in nailing down a date. ESA Director John Ward attributed the delay to the department falling into the throes of trying to prepare an ESA parent handbook, which ran well into June, and a staff with the bandwidth to do little more than daily operations. As of July 21st, a total of 86,423 students are enrolled in the ESA program, and according to Ward, approximately 4,000 student applications are still pending. Ward said the program dispersed $869 million in funds in fiscal year 2025 and stands to reach a billion, with over 90,000 students projected to be in the program the following year. All of this is handled by a staff of 40 people, including 12 purchase review specialists, which, considered the program scope, leaves employees, quote, always in survival mode, according to Ward. Ward said, quote, it's difficult for this very small staff to do much more than daily operations. Under state law, the Arizona Department of Education is mandated to conduct or contract for annual audits, as well as perform random and quarterly audits. A purchase backlog stretching close to 100,000 and a strain on staff led the department to implement a policy in December requiring all purchases under $2,000 to be automatically processed and reviewed later using risk-based auditing. Ward said the department had to take action, quote, before the wheels came off the bus. According to Doug Nick, a spokesperson for the department, purchase review staff perform audits on an ongoing daily basis. Employees review purchases exceeding $2,000, and Ward told the Joint Legislative Audit Committee that staff combs through a daily 250 orders below the $2,000 threshold for audit. During our audits, every single day, we catch something that represents misspending or inappropriate spending, Ward told lawmakers. We catch things every single day. Ward said the department has also been regularly meeting with the program's financial vendor, Class Wallet, about developing and implementing artificial intelligence to streamline the review process. He said they are first looking at using automation to identify anomalous purchase activity, with a grander goal down the line to create a system to vet whether purchases are allowable or not. A spokesperson for Class Wallet declined to provide further information about the development of artificial intelligence solutions, stating that the company is obligated by contract not to disclose program details to unaffiliated third parties. But in the contract signed by Class Wallet and the state treasurer's office in 2023, Class Wallet noted plans to incorporate business intelligence to automate purchase approvals. Nick confirmed the department had been working with ClassWallet on AI solutions for about 2 years, and Ward said they continue to, quote, put pressure to get it rolled out as quickly as possible. Joint Legislative Audit Committee Chair Senator Mark Finchem said the department's work with ClassWallet seemed a, quote, grand opportunity for consultation with the Auditor General's office, and prodded the two to finally set a meeting date. Quote, we got him, we got you. In 2 weeks, I'd like to know you've had a meeting, Finchem said. Perry told lawmakers that getting in step with the department was a continued priority. Quote, we look forward, as we did in January, to working with the department on this risk-based model. As you know, the Auditor General takes state law very seriously, Perry said. Once we have an agreement to meet, we'll get the right people in the room and have a good discussion. A spokesperson for the Arizona Department of Education could not confirm a meeting date just yet, but said the department would comply with Finchem's deadline. Headline: Tolleson School District under fire for low test scores, financial dealings. Written by Jacob Thorington and published in the Arizona Capital Times on July 27, 2025. Republican lawmakers are considering legislation next session to keep a closer eye on school districts and their governing boards next session. Members of the Joint Legislative Audit Committee said on July 21st that they plan to approve an audit of the Tolleson Union High School District after hearing testimony that raised several concerns for Republicans on the committee about the district's superintendent, Jeremy Kales. Kales and the school district were the main subject of the JLAC's hearing. One of the committee's co-chairs, Representative Matt Gress, a Republican from Phoenix, has scrutinized the district for months after it entered into a $25 million contract to help the Isaac Elementary School District recover from a budget deficit which exceeded $20 million. The deal involved selling the land rights to Isaac Middle School to Tolleson, only for Tolleson to turn back around and lease the building to Isaac School District so that the school didn't have to close. Kales testified to the committee that he is proud to have the highest average teacher salary in the state, the highest starting base salary for teachers, and the highest paid teacher in the state. Despite that, lawmakers pointed to state proficiency scores from district students and questioned how a district with an influx of cash could have low-performing test scores, referencing that district students scored an average of 22% in math proficiency in 2024 and 26% in English and language arts. The state's average is 30% and 38%, respectively. Tolleson's 87% graduation rate in 2024 was about 10% higher than the state average. Quote, "We're here focused on being a bank, loaning money to other institutions because it's a good idea," said House Majority Leader Michael Carbone, a Republican from Buckeye. Committee Chair, Co-Chair Mark Finchem suggested adding school districts to the SB 1487 complaint law, which allows lawmakers to request investigations from the Attorney General's office into a municipality when they believe the municipality has broken state law. School districts are currently exempt from that law. That idea likely wouldn't get far with Democrats, who are seeking greater oversight to empowerment scholarship accounts. Quote, "Before we put more on school districts in terms of scrutiny, we need to institute oversight on the universal voucher program since it's a billion-dollar expense," said House Assistant Minority Leader Nancy Gutierrez, a Democrat from Tucson. Quote, "District schools are already tasked with providing transparent budgets and spending. Universal vouchers are not, but they should be." Members of the committee also accused Kales of using his position as superintendent to enrich his school consulting firm, True Professionals. Kales said Isaac's former superintendent, Mario Ventura, initially reached out to him about the district's deficit, and although Kales was operating as a consultant to Ventura, he said he never billed Isaac for any of his services. Kales said he originally advised Isaac to seek a lease purchase through a bank. When Isaac didn't have 6 weeks to wait for a bank to approve that request, and the district's payroll was in jeopardy of being frozen, he said the plan changed to Tolleson entering into a contract with Isaac. The contract between the districts gives Isaac 12 years to repay the $25 million Tolleson spent on the middle school at a 6% interest rate, which Tolleson projects will result in a net gain of another $7 million. Quote, "Where you normally would have had $25 million sitting there generating nothing, you now have $7 million," Kales said. Gress said he believes this is predatory to taxpayers, since Tolleson taxpayers can't be guaranteed that they will ever see the $25 million return, and to Isaac taxpayers, who now have to help generate funds to pay the contract. Other officials from the city of Tolleson attended the hearing to testify about their interactions with Kales. Tolleson City Manager Reyes Mendrano shared details about a land deal the city and the district had in 2023, when the school district acquired the land where the old City Hall building was. According to Mendrano, Kales wanted the city to give the city an additional $85,000 along with the purchase of the land so that Mendrano could pay a broker that the city never engaged with. Quote, "When you're conducting any transaction between government bodies, it's very simple. Brokers, from our perspective, are unnecessary," Mendrano said. When Mendrano refused, he said Kales asked him to reconsider paying a broker because it would make the deal cleaner for Kales. Mendrano then prompted his team to carefully examine any future engagements with the superintendent. In his 20-year career as Tolleson's manager, Mendrano said Kales has been the most difficult superintendent that he's ever worked with. Kales and the city's police chief, Rudy Mendoza, also have a significant disagreement about the removal of a school resource officer from one of the district's campuses after that officer used excessive force on a student, leading to the school district ending its school resource officer contract with the city. Mendoza said he believed the decision was politically motivated by the district's governing board president, Lisa Sun. Sun was a former Democratic state representative who resigned from the legislature in 2024 after the House Ethics Committee concluded that she had threatened a Tolleson lobbyist. Quote, Sun clearly has an axe to grind with the city, Mendoza said. Other community members testified and accused the district of attempting to silence people during public comment at its meetings, pushing through curriculum without a public vote, moving board meetings to Glendale to keep constituents from attending, and hiding multi-million dollar expenses in the consent agenda during board meetings. Gress said he also plans to introduce legislation next year to make it explicitly clear that school officials can't conduct activities related to their private businesses while they're on the clock for school business, and to tighten conflict of interest requirements. Quote, if there was a clear example of the atrocious behavior that I've seen school districts display, look no further than the Tolleson Union High School District, Gress said. Quote, President Sun and Superintendent Kales are culprits, and they're culpable, and we will be looking into their behavior even more. You've been listening to the Arizona Capital Times, a production of Sun Sounds of Arizona. Thank you for listening.